and I'm Bill Conway. In your introduction, just give some description of what you do and say something interesting about yourself. So, I'm the Chief Quality Officer for the Henry Ford Health System. I'm a physician. I have 5 daughters and have spent a fortune on shoes.
Good morning. It's a real pleasure to be here with all of you. I'm Pam Cipriano. I am currently on faculty at the University of Virginia School of Nursing, having just completed a year at the Institute of Medicine as the nurse scholar in residence, working primarily on health information technology and safety and quality measures at the Office of the National Coordinator for Health IT. And I don't know if I can top the shoes, but probably my passion in life has nothing to do with healthcare. Well, sir, maybe indirectly, but I love to cook and have always spent many days in the kitchen, have always cooked for my family, but learned most of that from my immigrant grandmother who lived with us when I was young. So I've been able to carry on a lot of the Italian traditions in my family.
I'm Steve Wallace. I'm the Vice President of Quality and Safety with the Morris Foundation, a not-for-profit pediatric multi-specialty group. I cover, my venue is risk management, infection control, quality risk, and other things as assigned. I guess my interesting facet is I'm a diehard Yankee fan, and I still can't to this day believe that Albert Pujols got past the Feinbrenners.
I'm Saul Weingart. I'm an internist, and I'm a Vice President of Quality and Patient Safety at Dana-Farber Cancer Institute in Boston. I don't have many interesting things to report. I have to reach pretty deep. I did play the tuba for a brief period toward the end of high school, but not since.
Jason Edelman, I'm the Patient Safety Officer at Moscow Medical Center in the Bronx, right down the block from the Yankees. I'm a physician, internal medicine.
My name is Mary Seagreen. I'm an advanced practice nurse at the Detroit Medical Center. Just a short walk away from Henry Ford, and I am a board member of the National Pressure Ulcer Advisory Panel. I don't have a whole lot of interesting, or things that would be interesting to you. My favorite things, I guess, are my family. I have 2 daughters. One's an automotive engineer, what else, from Detroit, right? And the other one is a curator at the Detroit Zoo.
Good morning, everybody. I'm Chris Mahalik. I work with the Institute for Safe Medication Practices, where I'm a medication safety specialist. I'm a pharmacist by background. I've worked with ISMP for many years, just recently coming over full-time with them. And prior to that, I was director of pharmacy at Lehigh Valley Health Network in Pennsylvania. An interesting fact about me is I'm a big sports fan of any sports team that plays in Philadelphia, which is hard to do right now.
I'm Louise Post, the Executive Director of the St. Louis Area Business Health Coalition, and like other coalitions, we work with employers on issues of quality and affordability of health care. I'm a nurse by training. My favorite assignment as a nurse was the administrator of the medical services in Yellowstone, where I got to live for 7 years and do pre-hospital care.
Hi, I'm Lisa Nickefert with Consumers Union Safe Patient Project, and we work with grassroots individuals and organizations around the country to try to improve patient safety. And a couple months ago, I documented my trip across Greece by doing Tai Chi in all the major places like the Parthenon and Metaora, where there are monasteries and the islands.
Madison, and I direct the anticoagulation service at UC Davis, so I'm involved in anticoagulation in the hospital and out in the clinics. We're working now with other UCs to institute means of monitoring prophylaxis using the downloaded reports out of the electronic medical record. My claim of fame is I frequently call in very sick whenever it's snowing up in the mountains. I invariably get this disease called the runs, and can't make it to work.
Hi, my name is Lisa Moores. I'm a pulmonary and critical care doc in the Army at the Lew Walter Reed National Military Medical Center here in town. My real day job currently, though, is I'm the assistant dean for clinical sciences. I manage all the third and fourth year students at the Uniformed Services University. You might tell by my uniform I'm an Army fan, so this weekend was a bit frustrating. My son was a second year cadet at West Point, so at least I got to spend the day with him. I'll take that.
Hi, my name is John Clark. I'm a professor of surgery at Drexel University in Philadelphia, and I'm the clinical director of the Pennsylvania Patient Safety Reporting System, which collects about 1,000 reports of medical errors every day. We have about 1.5 to 2 million reports in our database, including a large number of complications. And as far as interesting facts, I'm writing a novel for my 11-year-old daughter.
Hi, good morning, everyone. I'm Tracy Wayne. I'm clinical research manager with WellPoint. I'm in the public health policy area. I lead patient safety efforts throughout the enterprise, and have been working pretty closely with the statewide patient safety collaborative in California. I'm a worship leader at church, so sometimes I do fill in as a drummer and pianist for other teams as well.
Thank you. Good morning, everyone. I'm Pat Quigley, and I'm a nurse scientist and a nurse practitioner with the Department of Veterans Affairs from Tampa, Florida. We have a patient safety center there and a research center of excellence for rehabilitation outcomes. And I'm here on behalf of the American Nurses Association, who put my name forward, I'm just honored to say. And to share with you, my husband and I have three adopted boys. And our three adopted boys are rescue basset hounds. So we are absolutely engaged in rescue basset hounds and the Suncoast Basset Rescue. So through them, we have three orphans who found a home forever.
Hi, I'm Valerie Hooper. I am the manager of nursing research for Mission Health Systems in Asheville, North Carolina, and I am a peri-anesthesia nurse by trade, and probably the most interesting thing about me, which freaks my husband out, is when I was a junior and senior in high school, I drove a school bus, because if you had good grades in high school, you could actually drive a school bus, which always freaks my husband out. But anyway, so I used to drive a school bus.
Hi, I'm Carol Kemper from Kansas City, Missouri, and I am a nurse by background and work at the Children's Hospital there, Children's Mercy in Kansas City, and I'm the Senior Director for Quality and Safety and the Center for Clinical Effectiveness. And so we are focusing on evidence-based practice and health outcomes and quality and patient safety throughout the organization. And an interesting thing is I just got back from China, and it was just thrilling today to not have to boil water before I brush my teeth.
Good morning. I'm Jim Smith. I'm a professor of physical therapy at Utica College in upstate New York. And the American Physical Therapy Association has specialty sections. We have an acute care section. I'm the president of that organization. And my interesting fact is similar in some ways to Dr. White, except when that snow melts, I get on it as white water. I'm hoping on our June trip to have more flexibility in my schedule coming in, because between upstate New York and here, there's lots of white water. I can go paddle and have some fun. I say June trip only because I saw the tentative schedule for a future meeting.
Good morning. I'm Charlotte Alexander. I'm from Houston, Texas. I'm an orthopedic hand surgeon, and I chair the quality committee for the Memorial Hermann Healthcare System, which is a large system we have in Houston. I have four children. Only one's a doc. She's pediatric ENT. The youngest one has no fear. Just finished a year in Mongolia. Has moved to Beijing. Doesn't have a job yet. Looking for one. And hopefully we'll be off the payroll pretty soon.
Good morning. I'm Susan Moffitt-Bruce. I'm a cardiothoracic surgeon. I practice at The Ohio State University. And about 18 months ago, I was anointed as the Chief Quality and Patient Safety Officer for the healthcare system. At that time, I also took up marathon running because it is somewhat akin to my current responsibilities, and enjoy that very much.
Good morning. My name is Iona Tragan, and I am in impressed by the brain power and the quality of folks sitting in this room. I'm a lowly MSW. However, I will say that as of this month, I am finishing a PhD in biomedical informatics at the U, so I feel like I'm catching up. I'm a slow bloomer, what do you call it, late bloomer. My daughter came down from New York City last night, and I got to see her all of about 2 hours last night when she came in and is off to Virginia for a job-related event. So I'm here to travel up to New York City on Friday to see her and spend the weekend, Christmas. Thank you.
I'm Jessica Weber. I'm a project analyst in the Performance Measures Department at MQF. Okay, my interesting fact will be I went to Thailand in September for a week. And, yeah, it was a great vacation. Really interesting.
I'm Heidi Bosley, Vice President of Performance Measures, filling as the Senior Director until Jesse Pines actually joins us. We'll have Jesse introduce himself as well. My interesting fact is I'm a twin, so there's another one of me out there, for better or for worse.
Hi, I'm Andrew Leisinger. I'm a project manager in performance measures at NQF. I'll just say off Jessica's trip. I just went to Vietnam pretty recently as a honeymoon. I also just got married a few months ago.
Janet, can you introduce yourself?
Sure. Good morning, everyone. I'm Janet Nagamini. I am trained as both a nurse and a physician. I started out as an ICU nurse and went back to medical school. I'm currently a practicing hospitalist at Kaiser Santa Clara in California. And within Kaiser, I've done patient safety work both at the local and regional, I guess, as well as some of the national programs. And I am a board member for Society of Hospital Medicine and am actively involved in their national quality and safety initiatives as well. Interesting facts, like John, I am working on documenting for my 8-year-old daughter. I'm working on a documentary about my father or her grandfather, and he was a lost soldier in China. So, Charlotte, I want to hire your daughter to start doing some research for me in China.
Hi, I'm Jesse Pines. I'm an emergency physician and health services researcher at George Washington University, right in town here. I'm also the director of the Center for Healthcare Quality. Very excited to be coming on in a part-time capacity starting next month, and I'm going to be working on this project specifically. Interesting fact that we have two very small children at home, 3 and 1.5, and a third on the way, so we are very busy.
Hi, I'm Arjun Venkatesh, down from Boston, from Brigham Women's and Mass General, and I'm here on behalf of the American College of Emergency Physicians.
Good morning, I'm Donna Swasper with the ASC Quality Collaboration. Do you want interesting facts about us? I love this scuba dive.
Good morning, I'm Denise Kruzanowski, a nurse with the Joint Commission. My interesting fact is I once swam in shark-infested water.
Hi, Dale Branson. I'm a professor at the University of Oklahoma Health Sciences Center. I used to drive a fire truck.
I'm Ann Watt. Good morning from the Joint Commission. I don't really think there's anything particularly interesting about me.
John Bott. I work under contract with AHRQ. Just got back from the Galapagos and swimming with the sea lions. Just a highlight, I think.
I'm Patrick Romano from the University of California, Davis in Sacramento. I'm here on behalf of AHRQ.
Heather Smith, I'm with the American Physical Therapy Association.
Hi, I'm Bob Rim. I'm the Assistant Vice President for Performance Measures at NCQA. And sorry I'm late, but between my scooter and the Metro, I didn't quite get here quickly enough. Interesting thing, I used to be a whale and dolphin trainer.
I'm Sarah McGallis, a senior analyst at NCQA. The first sport I ever learned to play was cricket.
Erin Giovanetti, a research scientist in geriatric performance measurements at NCQA, and this is my second week of work.
I'm Donna Lyon. I'm a senior healthcare analyst at NCQA. I, too, am from Florida, but I'm a strange Floridian who never likes the beach.
So this is always the fun part of the day. We're going to ask you to do some disclosures just for the committee members. Just a reminder, you're here as an individual. You may have been nominated by an organization, but again, you are here for your expertise in methodology, et cetera. We would ask you to disclose anything that you think would be relevant to the work of this committee. It doesn't necessarily have to be financial in nature. You may not have anything, and it's perfectly fine if you say you don't have anything, but anything that you did disclose perhaps on the form that you think should be at least known to your committee members, we would ask that you do that now. So, should we start? Sure. Yeah.
I have none to report.
I have none to report.
None to report.
I'm on the Board of Governors of the National Patient Safety Foundation. It's a non-fiduciary role.
None to report.
I have nothing to report.
Nothing to report.
Nothing to report.
Nothing to report except that I'm a shameless advocate for consumers. I'll become evident.
I have no relevant disclosures.
I have no financial. I will say I'm the immediate past chair of the Quality Improvement Committee at the American College of Chest Physicians.
I received funding for running the state patient safety program, and I sit on numerous advisory committees for WHO, ARC, et cetera.
I have nothing to report.
I have nothing to report.
I have no financial report, but I am the editor for the Journal of the Peri-Anesthesia Nursing.
I have nothing to report.
Nothing to report.
Nothing to report.
I have nothing to report.
Nothing here.
Janet?
No disclosures.
Okay. I ask this every time. Is there anything that your other members have said that you would like to discuss further? Usually it's no, that's fine. Okay, thank you.
Well, a bunch of nonprofit people here.
So why don't we run through, I think, quickly. Andrew, were you going to... Oh, you do have it up. Okay. Well, you went through an orientation previously, and the work groups have been meeting, so we're not going to spend a lot of time, but I just wanted to give you a sense of what we'll do today. First, we'll ask the developers to provide any context on their measures. During that initial discussion, we'll give them roughly 5 minutes if they would like to explain it. Then we'll turn it over to the individual who was assigned the measure to provide a brief overall summary of how you believe the measure did or did not meet the criteria. The workers went through the individual sub-criteria. So for importance, you discuss the impact, the opportunity for improvement, and the evidence. Here we're going to ask you to summarize that briefly. Then we'll open it up for discussion across the committee. When it comes to voting, we'll ask you to vote on the overall criteria. So you will do yes, no on importance, yes, no on scientific acceptability, usability, and feasibility. Just a reminder of the criteria. The first one is importance. That's, again, high impact, opportunity for improvement, and also evidence. and the evidence piece, again, depending on whether it's an outcome or a process measure, we'll walk you through that as a reminder, but outcomes, we're looking for a rationale. For process, we're looking for information on the quantity, quality, and consistency of the evidence. So again, all three of those sub-criteria must be met in order to pass importance. If the measure then passes importance, you move on to scientific acceptability, which is, again, is the measure precisely specified so that anyone who really wants to use the measure has the information they need to be able to do that. Is it reliable and valid? And then usability, again, is it useful for quality improvement and accountability? And then last but not least is the feasibility piece. So again, I'm not going to go through it specifically because you've been through it a few times, but is there any questions or anything you want to talk about specifically related to the criteria? We can also do it as we're going through the measures. Okay. Normally we don't have work groups meet before, so we spend more time on the criteria, but I don't think we need to this time. Okay. All right. Would we like to start on the first measure? Yes. Okay.
Okay. So we're going to start with the VTE measures. And Heidi, I think what you said, we would first ask our measure developers.
Yes.
Okay. So these first four measures are Joint Commission measures. And so we would ask if there is any comment that the measure developer would like to make. Maybe if we would just, we'll start with number 371. Just before you start, let me just ask for the members on this work group, since Mark is not here, does anyone who was on that work group have information specifically about it? Was there any discussion about who might present on behalf of the work group? Okay, we won't worry about that. All right, go ahead, please.
Good morning. Dale Rasker, I'm representing the Joint Commission today. On these measures, just a very brief background, I had the pleasure of co-chairing the Technical Advisory Committee along with Joe Caprini back when these measures were originally developed, actually an NQF project at that time. So venous thromboembolic disease is still far too common, still far too common in hospitalized patients, and is a known complication of hospital care. Indeed, when you look at patients who die of pulmonary embolism, the vast majority of those patients have been hospitalized in the recent past. So we think the measure set is very important, and our data sets demonstrate that there is remaining opportunity for improvement. DVT prophylaxis is underutilized, and we also know from both data that we have from hospitals that treatment protocols are not consistently followed. So that's a very brief background on the measures, and so this is a comprehensive measure, start of six measures that focus on both prevention and treatment of venous thromboembolic disease, and I'll certainly be happy as we move along through the individual measures to help provide the rationale from the conversations of both the technical advisory panel and the steering committee that endorsed these measures a number of years ago.
Okay, thank you. So if we will go measure by measure, and like what we would typically do is have our subgroup person speak to the different criteria. But maybe if we move to 371, and are we trying to put that on the screen? All of a sudden, mine is blank. My file. Do you have the same thing? Yeah, mine is blank. Is yours blank? That's what I downloaded. Okay. Okay. All right. Lisa, would you be comfortable walking through this measure in addition to the one that 373?
For me?
Yeah. Well, you can take a quick look at it as we're pulling it up. Lisa Morris? Ms. Morris? Thank you. Which ratings are you talking about? So not the composite.
I have a question about protocol. In terms of having questions about it, do you want to wait until the full walkthrough or during, or how do you want to handle that? If you have clarification questions.
I think we'll have each person present the one measure, and then after they've done their summary, then we'll take questions. Oh, okay.
Is there a way that we could have sort of an overarching discussion of these before we start?
Of this group?
Yeah.
Measures, the six
of
measures?
All the groups. I would like to, I mean, one of the things is, I think all of these are being re-evaluated, right? They've been out there endorsed. But most of them have been.
Yes,
so
yeah.
The
forward is maintenance.
And my understanding is that we're evaluating these for the purposes of public reporting. I may be wrong about that. There may be other purposes, but generally I think that's why we're looking at it. And I think that we should have a discussion about the value of process measures in public reporting. We basically feel that we should be focusing on outcome measures. However, there definitely, I think there's some definite value of endorsing the specifics of measures for providers to use internally to improve care. But for public reporting, I think it might be good to have a conversation about whether we want to keep going down this path of focusing on process measures.
To give a little context from NGF perspective, perhaps, and then I think it is worth having a conversation about this. The ultimate goal is, I think, for the most part, to have measures that are publicly reported, but there is a continuum on heading toward that, I think. And so when we view it, we look to see if a measure is useful for, first of all, quality improvement, and also for accountability. Again, I'll find a slide if I can and project it at some point to give you a sense of what we're thinking of. But we're looking at anywhere from quality improvement with benchmarking, perhaps maintenance of certification, use for accreditation, to the point of use for payment programs, and then ultimately public reporting. And a measure could actually be anywhere within that continuum. So that's the first thing I think, because Lisa, you started talking, really addressing the usability. The other piece, though, too, is we have not said that we are don't want to endorse process measures. Our preference, I think, is to outcome measures. But if we do endorse a process measure, it should be closely proximal to that outcome. So you don't want the measures that are more distal, perhaps something that looks at, I think a good example one of our committees looked at was prophylaxis ordered. You want to at least look at prophylaxis provided. And so you want to, if that's what I think you want to take a look at, it, the measures you have under consideration. You may give preference to the outcome measure. You may actually see that there is need and there is use for the process measures as well. So again, I think it's, we don't set a, we have a preference perhaps, but not necessarily something that says one over the other. But I think that's part of what you need to look at here. Many of these measures are under maintenance. They've been out in use for quite a while. Is there still need for them? Are you better with the outcome, or is there still need for the process measures? I think those are the things that you need to weigh today.
Maybe if I could, excuse me, to add to that, I sit on the consensus standards approval committee. And so that was a very similar discussion. Has occurred at that community. And I think that given where we are with the number of measures that exist today, and as you very clearly stated, many, many of them are process measures, not inclusive of the kinds of outcomes that we would like to measure. So I think we're in a transition phase where we are dealing with a universe of measures that are still relevant, but perhaps there continues to be a pretty high degree of desire that more outcome-based measures get developed, whether and including, you know, the composite measures we have, but then also new measures. So some of those measures are under development through contracts from CMS, and so we anticipate more measures coming forward in the next year. As you know, the timeline for measure development with different groups is pretty lengthy. So right now, we are staying true to the process of measure maintenance. And then as these measures work their way forward, I mean, some groups, not so much the patient safety, but some of the other more specialty-focused groups, we are seeing more and more measures being retired. So I think you can have confidence that, again, other groups are having a similar discussion about, you know, if we've reached complete saturation with no more opportunity for improvement or perceived, you know, there's very, very little opportunity, then those measures are being retired. So, again, I would sense that we're pretty much in a transition, and there has been a stated expectation that measures be much more outcome-oriented in the future. If you would put your name card up like this when you would like to speak, and then this way we can clearly identify you and try to keep track of the order.
So for the process measurement for venous thrombosis prophylaxis, I think a problem some of us have is it's easy enough to define if something is given, but the definition is variable from hospital to hospital as to what constitutes, quote, effective prophylaxis, and different guidelines come up with different suggestions as to what is effective prophylaxis. So really, you don't have a measure that's comparable between hospitals. I could create a risk model that said 85% of my patients do not need prophylaxis. I'll follow the ACP guidelines that just came out that says the doctor can make that judgment on their own, and prophylaxis is only required in high-risk patients. So you've got a nice measure. Yes, I put them on prophylaxis or not, but it varies amongst every institution according to what is deemed to be appropriate prophylaxis. One person may put on mechanical. Another one may say, I don't like those. I like foot pumps. And somebody else says, I don't like foot pumps. I just like heparin. And, you know, it's just, that's the problem, I think, is that the process measure isn't uniform in terms of the quality and the type of prophylaxis that may be administered.
John?
When I looked at the process measures, I'm enthusiastic. I'm not enthusiastic about process measures that are authority-based or opinion-based, consensus-based. But if a process measure has an evidence-based relationship with an outcome, I think it's perfectly valid to have a process measure. And in fact, I would argue that in some instances where the outcomes, presumably, if they follow practice, are negligible, I mean, that is, there's no adverse events, then you really only have the process measures as an indication of whether people, in fact, are providing best practice or just being lucky. So I think I evaluated these in terms of, is this process measure just something off the top of someone's head, or is this process measure based on something that we know is valid? And DVT is an excellent example of, if the processes are being done in a way which we know are valid, I think they're perfectly good process measures. But if they're being done the way Richard described, then they're totally arbitrary and worthless.
Hi, this is Janet. Can I make a comment?
Yes, please go ahead.
Yeah, so I would want to tag on to the conversation about measures, and I would say that there are many things that are good ideas. But is there evidence that it impacts the outcome is the question. And then I just wanted to add that if we are going to look at measures, I think we move more towards prospective audits where we're, for example, prophylaxis, we're looking at it when the patient's in the hospital, and we can still audit our performance. Did they or did they not prophylaxis? Did they or did they not have adequate prophylaxis? And then have a mechanism, if they didn't have prophylaxis, make sure that they get it, so that you're impacting care rather than retrospective basically saying we didn't perform very well. Thank you.
Okay, thank you. In the back, Director Commission.
Thank you. I realize I'm not a member of the panel, so I certainly defer to the panel. So I've been involved in both the development of process and outcome measures now for quite a number of years. And I think, you know, as we talk about measures today, we can take other examples. The vast majority of the measures that are submitted have an evidence base behind them that suggests that if you do these things correctly, you'll get better outcomes. I think one thing that's happened recently that we're starting to look at very carefully now is that there have been a lot of these papers that have been published trying to take data off of things like hospital compare on how individual hospitals are performing on process of care measures, and they haven't been able to predict patient outcomes in a variety of studies. You've seen it for AMI, heart failure, pneumonia, surgical care. And I think you have to be very, very cautious looking at those papers because there are some fundamental problems with many of those studies that have been done. The big one being that recognize when you create a process measures, by definition, you have to define a population that's eligible for that measure. But many of these papers that are looking at patient outcomes are looking at all cause events or the entire population of patients and not accounting for all of the patients who aren't eligible for the performance measures. So we've looked at numerous of topics now, surgery, AMI, heart failure, and we find that patients who aren't eligible for these process of care measures have much, much worse outcomes, very consistently across all the topics we've looked at. So you just have to be cautious in interpreting some of it. There's been a lot of press lately about the current process measurement system not defining outcomes for patients, or you can't predict hospital outcomes. But we just have to be cautious looking at that data because that's not what these process of care measures were designed to do, to predict outcomes at the level of the hospital. And to the points about that Rich made, you know, I understand the point about the adequacy of prophylaxis and the appropriateness. And we've talked about all those things, and we have the technical, so let's just say DTE1, which is prevention of the DBT prophylaxis, essentially, for a hospitalized patient. We do have some limited parameters of minimum effectiveness. So, in other words, we knew there was gaming of measures in the past, and so we won't capture a dose of unfractionated heparin of less than 5,000 units. You know, we define some of that in the specifications for the actual performance measure. But if I try to, from afar, as a process of care measure developer, define what the clinician does at the bedside, recognizing the patient may have multiple medical problems, chronic renal insufficiency, I can't define dosing and stuff without capturing a lot of data that makes the data collection completely unreasonable. Now, just look at data. So I'm going to use BTE1 as an example. Recognizing a volunteer groups or hospitals report this measure. It's not nationally reported yet. CMS has defined it, has suggested it would be reported starting in January 2013. But a volunteer group of hospitals that have been submitting it had a rate of performance on the measure of 68% at baseline. And I suspect that nationally, when it gets rolled out by CMS, assuming it's reendorsed, rates of performance are going to be much, much lower. So while I will agree that we may not look necessarily at adequacy of prophylaxis, there's a lot of patients that aren't getting anything or aren't being assessed for their risk at all. And I think that's primarily what we decided to focus on with this particular performance measure. You know, if somebody thinking about risk of VTE when a patient comes into the hospital, into the hospital, recognize that lots of patients in the hospital are at risk of these events. So this measure is not perfect. None of our measures are perfect. But that's the focus, is somebody thinking about risk? Is somebody assessing the patient, and if they're at risk, are they giving them prophylaxis, some form of prophylaxis, recognizing we don't have a perfect measure?
Iona.
This is going to be a shift in topic, so I want to make sure everybody's done before I make comments.
Okay, so in this, and this is maybe for future reference, and but I just want to bring it out now. Under the data source that's been identified for these particular measures, and it's common across all of the measures, I would ask that the either NQF or the vendors consider identifying the specific code, national codes that they're recommending associated with their particular measure, so that as we move forward into meaningful use, either the IC9 codes that they're recommending be used for data sources, or the laboratory LOINC codes, or the SNOMED codes, whatever it is that is associated with capturing the data associated with those measures, that they begin to include that moving forward.
Okay, so I think what you're suggesting is that measure developers put forward the electronically tooled measures, and Heidi, I guess I would ask if there's been discussion that might guide that. It's almost like a whole other measurement development activity. There are a limited number that have been electronically retooled by NQF, about 116 measures. And as new measures are being developed, many are being developed exclusively as electronically retooled measures. And maybe, Heidi, if you could comment on any discussion about expectations of measure developers that has occurred.
Right. So, first of all, as you evaluate the measures, if it's specified for a data source that would require codes, like ICD-9, LOINC, et cetera, they should be provided to you. And if not, we've either not included it in here, or we need to get it from the developers. So that's the first thing. But for measures, we do not yet have a requirement that all measures that come forward, or the vast majority of measures, be specified for electronic health records yet. We're in the process of, there's several things that need to occur before we can get to that point. We have had several measures, and I think some of the ones that are before you have been what we're calling retooled. So they were measures that were previously for paper medical records, have actually now been respecified to be used in electronic health records. In that instance, again, if we're missing it, we'll get it to you, but you should be provided the e-measure, which includes kind of the clinical logic of how you would calculate that measure electronically. It should include the code sets mapped to the quality data model. So again, giving greater detail on how you would pull that information, where it should be stored in an electronic record and then pulled out. And then actually the fun thing that I can still read, the XML format. So that should be provided if it has been retooled to date. Developers are also providing that to us from time to time when they're ready and they're bringing it forward. But we're not yet to the point where we can say that anything that, for example, paper medical records should come forward with electronic health record specifications.
The only reason I raise that is because this is a three-year endorsement process, and some of these measures are already being required, preventable conditions, et cetera, et cetera. ICD-9 codes are already being put out there. So if we approve it in its current form, it's going to be another 3 years before.
Perhaps, but probably not. So what will happen as well is we have an annual update process. So anytime a measure is not within maintenance, we ask the developers to provide updates on coding, specifications, et cetera. If at that point, for example, if it was used for meaningful use or something, we would actually ask them to bring in that e-measure specification to us. We'd review it. Probably would not require a full review, but there's no reason to say that it would take 3 years to get that in. It might, but for the most part, I would say for a lot of these measures, I expect it may happen faster.
Yeah, I would say that I think we definitely appreciate the recommendation, because right now it does limit the universe of measures that can be selected for programs like meaningful use. So are there any additional general comments about the six measures? We've got four right ahead of us, but there was a total of six in the VTE prophylaxis group. Are there any additional comments of the work group on general terms about the discussion about the process that you went through before we move then to each individual measure? Okay, so are we ready to start with measure 371? And if you have the electronic spreadsheet that was sent around last night, right? That's the one we should be using.
which has the composite of your votes, then we can quickly look across the tally for each of the criteria. I said, for this first measure, we don't have a specific spokesperson, but we can look at the individual ratings and decide whether or not the group is ready to support an action on this particular measure. So maybe if we just walk through this first one as a group, and is there anyone having difficulty getting the numbers? If your eyes are good enough to see the screen, they are posted on the screen over there. And then just scroll over? Ah, okay. All right. So under the measures of importance, it's almost all H's, so high in terms of those criteria. Is there evidence to support? Yes. I have to switch back and forth here to my other. As we look at usability, again, almost exclusively H's, except for 4B. Let me see what 4B is. Scroll down. Are the data elements needed for the measure as specified available electronically? And 4C is susceptibility to inaccuracy, errors, or unintended consequences of the measurement identified during testing and or operational use and strategies to prevent, minimize, or detect. So there's a little variability in that section. And if we look at the last two columns, again, pretty fairly high consensus in terms of feasibility and then on suitability, all but one vote. Richard.
So how does the Joint Commission, when they look at this, how do they, what do they use for their guidelines for the use in a specific hospital? I mean, does the hospital have to provide a risk model and say, I have low risk, intermediate risk, high risk, and did they get the, what they term the appropriate prophylaxis? Or using some national guidelines. Again, it's my way of looking at it. It's a question of validity. I might have a very easy risk model and just put everyone on mechanical prophylaxis and say, as far as I'm concerned, that's where the literature goes, and they would be out of level of acceptance from most other hospitals, and other ones may be very aggressive. So I'd like a little clarification.
So the way the performance measure is structured, we have many, many conversations about the need for risk assessment. As you know, my co-chair has been a proponent of risk assessment for VTE, Joe Caprini, for many years. But at the time that we developed the performance measure, and I actually would argue that even today, there are not well-validated risk adjustment models out there to determine whether or not, does a person with 10 points versus 5 points have a greater risk of VTE? It's just not been clinically validated. So we developed the performance measure that basically defaulted to either prophylaxis or documentation of why the patient did not get prophylaxis. Now, if you look at the details of the specification, actually allow the hospital to use a developed risk assessment form to make that determination of whether or not the patient needs prophylaxis. So if they have a form that they use and the physician, or we also allow documentation by the nurse, APN, the advanced practice nurse, PA, or the pharmacist, if they use some type of the standard protocol and they determine that the patient is at low risk and doesn't need prophylaxis, that passes the performance measure. Again, here the primary focus was to make the hospital think about VTE at the time that a patient is admitted. They either with prophylaxis, or they document in the medical record why the patient doesn't need prophylaxis, and that can be through risk assessment. But we don't specify what that is because I'm not sure what I would recommend. I think Greg Maynard's work is an example of something that's worked well and is simple, and I really promote it a lot, but is it clinically valid? I don't know yet.
So that proves the problem. In the stroke study in England, they put on braided compression stockings, and they had actually worse outcomes, more skin breakdown, et cetera, and ACP now advises against the use of braided compression stockings. But then experts can say, well, they put on TED hose, and they don't have a measured gradient, and they might have been too high a pressure at the knee and not enough at the ankle, and that's what caused the problem. So now we're down to the brand and the type. And none of these are specified, really. I mean, to me, that's the real issue. It's kind of a little game. I mean, you could put some kind of foot pump on everybody and say you got a risk model, and that's what it is. And someone else in another hospital says, in my opinion, that's ineffective. And yet, you score well with the process measure because it fit your risk model. So that's my only problem with this whole thing is that we don't have those validated risk assessment tools, and the elucidated best optimal prophylaxis, and yet we're measuring it in everyone.
Right. So I would agree. We don't have validated risk assessment, and that's why this is actually a measure set, because we get to the end of the day, the end of the measure set, the potentially preventable, then we start looking at, okay, here's a patient that developed a VTE in the hospital, wasn't present on admission. Now, did they, you know, were here the goals to have a low rate, and you would assume that if the patient's at higher risk, the hospital would start thinking about the use of adequate prophylaxis. And so that's actually one of the reasons we paired these measures, because the last measure, VTE6, looks at, is the risk assessment that the hospital is using sufficient? Are they identifying the high-risk patients that are more likely to need prophylaxis and giving it? So I completely agree, but again, Rich, I think the fundamental problem still in U.S. hospitals, and you probably know as well as any, that a lot of patients don't get anything or aren't assessed at all, and people just don't think about it. And there's some good work out there where people have done it, but like I say, a group of hospitals have volunteered, you know, 35-36% of the patients had no assessment of risk and did not get prophylaxis at all.
Well, let's just do one acid test. So let's say in my hospital I say that aspirin is effective. And I write it in my guidelines and everyone gets aspirin. And no one else in the United States believes it's effective. Do I have a good performance measure? Is that allowable?
It would fail because we actually exclude the aspirin. It's not acceptable in the performance measure specifications. So we look at either mechanical prophylaxis or pharmacologic prophylaxis, and it has to be unfractionated heparin, one of the low molecular weights, or one of the thrombin inhibitors on the Paranox. But we do not, or warfarin. But we do not, the specifications do not allow it.
Is that listed our specifications here of acceptable prophylaxis? I must admit.
We can pull up the specific date element, but aspirin is explicitly excluded.
Okay, let me go ahead with, we've got a number of speakers lined up. We have Pat, Lisa, Jason, and Valerie. So Pat, let me go ahead with you.
Thank you, Pam. My comments are very different than the clinical relevance and appropriateness. So, Pam, my comments are related to my reading of scientific acceptability of the measure. So it was a different section, and I just needed a little bit of clarification. I actually had rated this as medium because there were some very good staff comments. And I apologize if the documents that I have here that I downloaded, because Andrew gave me the flash drive, don't have the staff comments on them. I have them actually on my files at work. I can access the VPN. But my question is, you know, how very specific do the actual measurement criteria have to be? Because there were questions that staff had raised about was all the measurement information really there in terms of defining episode of care, or I think it was, and the age criteria, other kinds of things. And even like, you know, for the denominator, it says all discharged patients, but in other sections it says all discharged patients, but with a whole series of exclusion criteria. So in terms of a performance measure, I think the staff input has just been invaluable as they review this for us, but I just didn't know how clear this really has to be. So my comments and my questions are really very different than the clinical relevance and, of the measure. So I apologize if I was out of context.
Let me ask if Heidi or Andrew have a
specific.
Well, those comments were raised in several of the indicators that we received, so...
And Pat and others in the work group then, do you feel that the composite ratings that we have, though, have taken into consideration your previous deliberations from the work group discussion?
Yes.
Okay.
But my question was really related to the clarity. Once this really gets adopted, you know, the clarity of the measure that's used by everybody, so...
And again, I think N2F staff typically will provide interpretation and clarity, you know, for anyone trying to use the measure, and they give feedback to the measure developer.
Thank you.
Okay, Lisa?
Well, I was wondering if there's information in here. I couldn't find it in most of them about... How are these have all been used for quite some time, and in the introduction there was some discussion about, you know, do we need to maintain? Do we need to maintain them, or have we already reached, you know, the point where everybody's doing this? I think that's what was said. At least that's what I heard. And so I'm wondering if we have any information about. You know, what are the, is this being measured, let's see, I saw somewhere where it's been used, the requirement of participation in the ORIX initiative, but is this being, I think this measure is out there, is it on the Hospital Compare?
No, it's not.
No, it's not. Okay.
So far it's only been used voluntarily by Joint Commission accredited hospitals that have wanted to use it through their ORIX initiative. But CMS has defined this measure set for national implementation for January 2013 discharges, where it then would then go on Hospital Compare. But it's not been used nationally. So we think there's still a great opportunity for improvement.
Hey, Jason.
Yes, ma'am.
Sorry. Can you hear me? Sorry. I just want to weigh in.
I'm sorry, Jason. We have a Jason committee member. So this is Jason Adelman.
Thanks. I wanted to weigh in on the starlight conversation about the difference between the accuracy and appropriateness of the DVT prophylaxis and just the fact that it's addressed. But I've seen the issue clinically at my own institution about the lack of DVT prophylaxis being addressed. It was mentioned in one of the references, they mentioned the indoor survey where that was also a major gap. And I see an analogy of simple immunization where the appropriateness is not really an issue. It's just often doesn't get done. And so I do see the value in simply keeping track if DVT prophylaxis is addressed and not getting into the clinical appropriateness. I mean, we are far away, I think, from looking at the appropriateness of antibiotics and other treatments in any sort of real way, but I do think we can push the point of addressing something as simple and, I believe, and it was shown, often overlooked as DVT prophylaxis.
Okay, thank you. Valerie.
In listening to the conversations, I guess it seems that there is much consensus regarding the need for risk assessment. And, of course, we want to move towards outcome. But I agree that there just seems to be a lot of issues with what is appropriate prophylaxis. And I will preface with, this is not my area of expertise, but it seems that the evidence is mixed regarding what is appropriate prophylaxis. So that in and of itself seems to be problematic from a quality measurement perspective. I agree that it seems that there is great consensus that there needs to be risk assessment, and then if we have a measure of the actual outcome, does unintended VTE occur? It seems that what we do for prophylaxis at this point, the evidence seems quite mixed, and so I would think it would be difficult to measure. Thank you.
Again, I guess I would ask Dale if you have any comment to that.
Well, so our committee, when we were meeting, talked a great deal about the whole risk assessment. So I'm going to push back a bit and say that some people believe that if you're in the hospital, you're at risk. Because, frankly, look around hospitals today. We don't admit very many fully ambulatory, healthy people anymore. They're all managed in the outpatient setting. Most people in the hospital are at risk. And so some centers have addressed VTE prophylaxis by exception. You know, it is the rule unless the patient can clearly be defined as somebody that doesn't need prophylaxis. And that's somewhat of the approach the committee took, was that the majority of patients that are sick enough to be hospitalized today probably need to be on some form of VTE prophylaxis, though I can't define what is best. And I certainly can't define at the bedside, recognizing there are many nuances that will make the clinician at the bedside decide mechanical prophylaxis versus various forms of pharmacologic prophylaxis and all the other decision-making points. So we took the position that either the patient should be on prophylaxis or there should be some form of a risk assessment or documentation by the physician that it's not needed. But we weren't going to put ourselves between the clinician and the patient and the bedside, and that's the way we define the metric.
Okay, thank you. Jason Edelman again.
Sorry, I just wanted to say one other thing. The idea of the evidence around DVT prophylaxis, so I think Dr. White is really, this is his expertise. But my understanding, Dr. Clark made a point earlier that the better process measures are ones where there's really good evidence behind them. As far as DVT prophylaxis, there's the ACCP guidelines, which I've looked at extensively. There's like 700 references. They have recommendations for many, many different kinds of diseases. If somebody comes in and they fracture the hip versus an elective hip replacement, and then each recommendation is graded based on those 700 references. Some of them would meet, Dr. Clark's criteria of really well evidenced based on randomized controlled trials, and others lean more towards expert opinion. But it's not like we have no idea what we're doing. There are lots of pretty good guidelines out there with a lot of evidence. We're not just starting from scratch.
Heidi, this is Janet. Comment when you're ready.
Janet, go ahead.
All right. So I just wanted to summarize a few thoughts. I've spoken at great length with Greg Maynard about this. Prophylaxis measure doesn't make sense to keep track of how we're doing, absolutely. And just a few points or comments that may help strengthen the measure. I think in the absence of a validated risk tool, measuring adequacy of prophylaxis is going to be difficult. That said, it is one of the sort of criticisms of this measure, but it all depends on how high you want to set the bar. And my feeling is you've got to start somewhere, and especially until we come up with a validated risk tool that looks specifically at the risk of bleeding, because that's what we don't want. We don't want everyone to be prophylaxed and bleed, and that happens in specific populations, the renal patients, the older patients. So we don't want to cause harm by trying to prevent a VTE either. The other thing is that the ACP guidelines that just came out November 1st definitely leans